Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 14th, 2020. My talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Appamadivaga, the second chapter in the Dhammapada. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Tonight's talk is from the second chapter of the Dhammapada, the Appamadivaga. Last Saturday, some of you heard the talk on the Yamakavaga, the first chapter in the Dhammapada. Both of these initial chapters speak to the importance of right mindfulness. The Buddha taught a very specific application of mindfulness that is framed by the Eightfold Path. And the Dhammapada is a 26-chapter book in the Kodaka Nikaya that many scholars think is a primer that would have been given to novices to get them going in the right direction. It's not all that important whether it was or not, except in the context of understanding just what the Dhammapada is. These 26 chapters provide a very concise, a very pithy, but complete teaching in the Dhamma. But as we know, we have to understand how to apply all these different things. But it's a remarkable book. We're going to go through all 26 chapters over the summer, right after our spring retreat. And so this chapter, again, is on beginning of the Dhammapada, the second chapter. Again, the Buddha's teaching the importance of refined mindfulness. And when you think about the Dhammapada as an instruction manual, this is where the Buddha's starting his instructions, with the importance of right mindfulness. You could also say that he's starting out his Dhamma teaching, loosely addressing the fourth foundation of mindfulness, meaning to be at peace, to understand the quality of your mind in this moment, and be at peace with it no matter what it is. So let me read the chapter. The Buddha's words. He starts right off with what Dhamma practice is all about. These are general terms, but we understand when the Buddha is saying mindfulness, he's talking about refined mindfulness, meaning, again, mindfulness that is resting in a mind well concentrated through jhana meditation and is able to hold in mind the Eightfold Path as its way of living in the world. Mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, and so we can hold in mind or recollect anything, and we could literally call it mindfulness. For many, many years, I spent 24 hours a day completely mindful. A human being could not be more mindful than I was for many, many years. And this started when I was 12 years old, except it's a type of mindfulness that almost killed me. I could not let go of the thought that I need a drink or a drug. That's mindfulness, folks. That's holding in mind. I'm using a bit of an exaggeration to make the point. Just because we might be practicing mindfulness by holding something in mind, meaning I'm mindful of walking the dog, or I'm mindful of walking, or mindful of driving, or mindful of washing the dishes, that's great, but that's not Dhamma practice. Dhamma practice is holding in mind the principles that develop awakening, meaning the Eightfold Path. And here the Buddha is emphasizing that. There's probably nothing more emphasized than right mindfulness in the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha says, mindfulness is the path to cessation. Those mindful do not suffer. Those mindful have gone beyond suffering. And every one of us has talked about having that experience, even if it's just in the moment in a temporary experience, meaning in this moment, I'm well concentrated and my view of myself in relation to the world is framed by the Eightfold Path. Those mindful do not suffer. There's no suffering in that moment. And all of us have talked about that. The release and the peace of simply being present in our life as our life occurs, seeing things from right view. Which relates to just what the Buddha is saying next. Clearly knowing the excellence of mindfulness, the wise, exulting in mindfulness, and the refuge of the noble ones. The wise ones established in jhana, steadfast in the heart. When the Buddha refers to heartwood, he's always talking about the Eightfold Path. They alone are released, freedom beyond compare. Glorious are those energetic, pure, discerning, rightly restrained, and always mindful. That's something the self-referential ego personality doesn't want anything to do with, being rightly restrained. Mm. And ego personality is always, I should call it anatta, fabricated views of self, is always grasping after more. It's never satisfied in this moment. It's the nature of ignorance to always be grasping after more ignorance-inducing experiences. Mindfulness, right mindfulness, is the way out of it. Mindful of right effort, a disciple of Heartwood, the wise are an island unto themselves that no flood can overwhelm. The foolish and ignorant crave mindlessness. The wise know this one treasure. The foolish and ignorant crave mindlessness. And again, you could use me as an example, those years that I spent in a bottle and sniffing things I shouldn't have been sniffing. That was craving. It was a form of mindfulness that in the moment was craving mindlessness. In this moment, what I'm saying, every time I took a drink, I was telling myself and the world around me that I can't live in this moment. There's something terribly wrong with me in relation to this moment that I cannot deal with. Let me drown it or drug it away. And I'm using an extreme example, but we do that with ordinary things. Some people watch too much TV, spend too much time on Facebook, talk to their friends too much, whatever it might be. Some people might even golf too much. I'm just kidding. It's hard to golf too much. The extreme example of addiction is played out in very common, ordinary, day-to-day, moment-by-moment life. We do it all. It's the nature of distraction to be addicted to whatever our distraction we find most acceptable. And some of us, it goes to the point where it doesn't matter if it's acceptable or not. I just need to be mindless in this moment. But again, we do that in much more subtle ways when we insist that in this moment I need to be distracted. Most human beings find acceptable means, or more acceptable means than outright addiction. And believe me, I had many other ways of distracting myself. I'm just using that as an example. You could say that the world is set up as an ongoing vehicle for distraction. One of the things that I find more and more striking, I guess is the right word, is when I watch TV, or even, well, I don't really read magazines anymore. I can't. It's just the constant push to put something in my face so I'll buy it or be distracted by it. And it seems like, and maybe it's because I'm a little detached from that, that it seems so much more violent and aggressive, but it maybe not. And again, the world, everything is put out there. Look at this, look at this. Don't concern yourself with where you are in your life. This will make it better, whatever it might be.
When you go into a news feed, you know, it does that by design. It just finds all these things that you have clicked on once or twice, and it keeps feeding you until you, and you don't really stop clicking on it because it keeps being more and more interesting.
Well, that's the phrase for that, developed in the internet age, is clickbait.
Yep.
We want to put something in your face that you have to click on because of craving. It make me so desirous of whatever this is, I have to go for it. Of course, it's easier to blame modern technology for that, or even the world. But the Buddha described that 2,600 years ago. The difficulties in the world today are the same as they were 2,600 years ago, meaning the root cause is ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
And it's insidious because it preys on you because it's feeding you what you believe in.
Yep.
And it's the same thing as your beliefs, your wrong view.
Yes.
So you surround yourself with like-minded people, and it's just keeps feeding that cycle.
Yeah, like-minded, mindless people. True. I mean, that's really what is occurring. And we can't blame the world or other people or technology or Google or Facebook for any of it. We're the ones that do it. We give in to our own desire. If it wasn't that way, if we weren't the ones that are ultimately responsible for our own distraction, then we could not be responsible for developing concentration, could we? The radical thinking of Siddhartha Gautama 2,600 years ago was just that, that we are in complete control of how we experience our life moment by moment, which was a complete contradiction to all of the philosophies and religions of his time, just as it is today. Just as it is today. We have the path to develop a mind concentrated and able to support the refined mindfulness, to see things as they really are, and maintain a mind of calm and peace. Let me continue. I'll say that one line again. The foolish and ignorant crave mindlessness. The wise know this one treasure. Refrain from mindlessness. Refrain from sensual pleasures. Only those established in jhana and refined mindfulness attain lasting calm. The wise, looking down from the mountaintop of wisdom, I love that line, the mountaintop of wisdom, having abandoned mindlessness, having established mindfulness, this peaceful sage observes the foolish and suffering multitude. Just observes. The Buddha's not condemning that in any way, is he? He's just saying he observes, he notices it. Mindful among the mindless, awake among those asleep, the wise advance like a swift horse. By mindfulness is one exalted. Mindfulness is always praised by the wise. Mindlessness always despised. The Dhamma practitioner who delights in mindfulness and is fearful of mindlessness advances like fire burning away all fetters. The Dhamma practitioner who delights in mindfulness and is fearful of mindlessness will not lose the way. They are close to release. I thought that was it. That's the end of that beautiful little chapter. So you can't really emphasize right mindfulness enough, can you? And it is Dhamma practice, like we talked a little bit about on Saturday, to change the way we think, which is what we're holding in mind. So I'm developing a way of changing my mind that is constantly distracted, constantly craving after and clinging to fabricated views. Within that same mind, developing concentration and the refined mindfulness to abandon all of those ignorant views, and what's left is a pure mind. The point that I'm emphasizing is a subtle point that the Buddha's talking about. The very same human being whose mind was once rooted in ignorance is the same human being that awakens. That is such an important point, it's almost too obvious to see. But when we develop, just to use the word, dharmas that seek an external intervention in some way, then I'm not in control anymore, am I? Or establishing myself in some speculative non-physical realm is the same thing. I'm saying, I can't do it here, I'll do it there. And most of modern Buddhism is presented that way, as a future attainment, where the Buddha always taught awakening occurs right here, right now, in this human lifetime. So that's my talk for tonight. Let's go online first and see what, let's start with Karen. Karen, how are you? No, maybe you too.
Hello.
There you are. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm sorry. I never know when I'm muted or not muted. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I've really been enjoying this book. Thank you so much for sending it.
I'm glad you got it and you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
What did you think of tonight's little talk?
It was very enlightening. I mean, it gives me a lot to think about in terms of the many myriad ways that I distract myself, as you said, with television and whatnot. And so I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Yeah, I'm glad you joined us tonight, Karen. And thanks for the email earlier.
Thank you.
Helen, how are you?
Hi, John. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad you joined us tonight.
Thanks. Yeah, I decided not to be there and share my cold. But I'm enjoying it here. As the years go by, the clouds part and it becomes clearer and clearer.
What a nice way of putting it. It does. And it's just a matter of being part of it, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
I'm glad you joined us and I hope you feel better soon. Jane, how are you tonight?
Thank you.
I'm fine, John.
Good.
Thank you for the teaching.
I'm just grateful that I have this path.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad you joined us tonight. Last but not least online is Thad. How are you, Thad?
Hello, John. Good to be here. I'd like to ask you just to speak a little bit, if you could. You know, sati is the term, the Pali term we usually, mindfulness, recollection. And I noticed in Appomattox, I believe I might be mispronouncing that, but I looked in the Pali Dictionary, and it seems to have a little bit more of an energetic quality you know, like vigilance or diligence or something. Would you speak a little bit? Is there a really any kind of, you know, we have this one word in English, mindfulness, but is there in this, is it emphasizing a certain different kind of quality of mindfulness, or is it, or speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you, Ted. Yeah, I mean, it's a, I did touch on a little bit. The energetic of mindfulness within the Dhamma rests in jhana, rests in the right meditation practice, because it takes a well-concentrated mind to know how to apply what it's holding in mind and to recognize the things that, if held in mind, will only contribute to further confusion, delusion, and suffering, and those things that are skillful to hold in mind, meaning the Eightfold Path. And so as Dhamma practitioners, authentic Dhamma practitioners, we develop and integrate all eight factors of the Eightfold Path, including the last factor of right meditation, and the other seven factors which contribute to this refined sati or mindfulness. So the Pali and probably Prakrit language that the Buddha taught, nobody really knows the exact dialect, I can't remember the word, the type of language that Pali is. Can you think of that word? Yeah, it's the words are much more, or can be much more broader in scope in what their meaning is, and so that sati, using it that way, means a very specific refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path as the Buddha uses it. So, but then going back into language, you can find instances of sati applied to an infinite number of things. So there's mindfulness, and then there's mindfulness, as these two suttas, these two first chapters, point out. So does that help, Dad?
Yes, it does. Thank you, John.
Okay, good. Thank you for the question.
Does Appomattox have a different flavor to it than sati?
No, not in the context of the Buddha's Dhamma. And one thing this is something I struggled with many years ago when I was starting to retranslate the suttas, is being too fixed on a word and what a word means, rather than understanding the broader context, which is how you should, any good translator will translate that way anyway. And you understand the context, and then you apply the word, rather than get caught up in a word and have it alter the context. And the big breakthrough for me in my understanding of the Dhamma was just seeing the consistency of what the Buddha was teaching. He used the same terms like mindfulness in a very specific way, or jhana, or karma, pick anyone. He's all very consistent about how he uses those, and that's how you glean the meaning of it. No matter whether you're translating something, you know, from the ancient Greek, it doesn't matter. You have to understand the context, and then you can apply the words properly. So.
Yeah, I'm starting to see in what I'm working up for the training that it may even make sense to use different translations of the same word in the same sutta.
Oh yeah, I mean,
as the parts of the sutta unfold, he's talking about subtly different things.
Yep, there's a online. There's a Pali to English dictionary that's very helpful in doing that. Mm-hmm. But when I get kind of caught up in a translation, I'll often look at three or four different sources and see where they're coming from, and then again come back to what the Buddha consistently taught. And when you put things in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, then it's obvious what the meaning of the words were, rather than getting lost in those words. So we might as well start with you.
Thank you. This sutta has a sharper focus to it than the one we talked on Saturday. Yeah, this one is almost, it's funny, I'm starting to think in pictures, you know, especially the Dhammapada suttas are like a little, this one is like a little gem, just stuff is sparkling in here.
Yeah, I agree.
While the previous one add a lot more description to it. Yeah. This one seems to be the culmination of mindfulness, the really refined mindfulness, mm-hmm. where the previous one had a lot more to do with how we start out in mindfulness, how we apply it in everyday yeah. life. And as we're going along, it's we're using it for the other factor of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, it's brilliant. You could see these two beginning chapters as just that, a very broad approach. This is what mindfulness is, and then this more narrow approach. This is how you apply it. This is what it looks like. And you'll see, as we'll see this summer, as you build through, each chapter is brilliant, and they all feed off of another, resulting in the sutta that I taught just a couple weeks ago, the Brahmanavaga, which was the culminating chapter, the 26th chapter. It's just marvelous. So, Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Good. Really appreciate this. Like Ram said, I agree. There's a lot of facets to this gem that you know you can really pick out here, and that's kind of what the fun in the Dhammapada is, sort of extracting the Dhamma out of it, and that's a different type of applied learning with this, and mm-hmm. it's nice and refreshing to read these sometimes. I've always been fond of the piece of text there, to be an island unto yourself. I think Dathayan mentioned that over the weekend. Yep. Or recently in his contribution. So that's where I'll leave it. I want to be an island to myself, or would like to be.
Yeah. So thank you. What does that mean, be an island to yourself? It doesn't mean we should be isolated from the world. Again, remember the context. The Buddha's talking about Dhamma practice. Within Dhamma practice, we are an island unto ourselves. Don't keep associating with outside things and calling it Dhamma practice. It's just this one thing.
Islands aren't so bad either.
No, I like it. I like that. Good evening, Lorna.
Evening. I'd like some clarification on something that goes on in my mind when I meditate. Often when I meditate, I can get to a place where I am just thinking about my breath, and I seem to disassociate myself with all my senses and aggregates and all the stuff that we think about that draw our attention, and sometimes I just sit there and think about my breath, and there's nothing else going on. Meaning, what you've just talked about tonight, and there was a sutta a couple of classes ago as well, and Buddha described, you know, the what to hold in mind when we're meditating, etc. But when I get in that state, I don't know if I am holding anything in mind, or because actually I just sit and bask in it. I just sit and bask in the nothingness. And I don't know if actually that's a right or wrong approach to meditation, where you should be more conscious of. Or I don't know if I've done enough homework for me to get there, to understand that quiet and peaceful place. And that is learning meditation. And I can, because as I say, sometimes I just sit and bask in that stillness and quietness and nothingness, and just understand that there's nothing really going on in the world. So is that good or bad? Because he never says, you know, when your mind does empty, love it, you know, just sit there and bask in it. And he never does say that. He always like, be mindful of that.
No, you know why Siddhartha never would say that?
No.
Because it goes without saying.
Well, I wish you'd say it, then I'd know.
You are describing the results of a well-focused Dhamma practice, and a well-focused that's what it is.
Okay.
And maybe the questioning or the unsureness. What would be the right word for unsureness? uncertainty. It's just because it's unfamiliar, and you're comparing it to a very, very busy mind. Well, this can't be it. Mm. It is that. Mm. That's what it is. And one of the reasons why people have such a hard time achieving it is because we don't want it. We don't want, in general, we don't want a calm and peaceful mind. Well, here it is. You put the work in. You've been meditating and developing a Dhamma for a couple of years, and this is the result. Is that good?
It's lovely.
Yeah. And you get to bask in it. You get to listen to what Lorna said. we get to bask in our own minds. Yeah. And we could say we get to bask in our own bodies, too. That's the whole point.
So she gets to shed the hindrance of doubt because she'll come to realize that that's what she's trying to attain in that second jhana.
Yeah. And you're right. And there's just that little shred. Is this right? Am I doing this right? But that all comes from ignorance, doesn't it? But it's also part, that's not a negative thing. That's all part of Dhamma practice. It's just what you just did, is questioning it and relating it back to how things used to be and how things are right now. And you notice the difference.
Is there also
mindfulness, too, by the way. Yeah. The proper mindfulness is being able to hold in mind the principles so that we can recognize that we are actually developing the Dhamma the way it's intended and basking in a calm and peaceful mind. It's wonderful.
Is there also an aspect of impermanence there still?
Yeah, well, there always is. You know, isn't there? I mean, we talked a little bit about this on the way down. The Dhamma itself is a practice of complete acceptance of the impermanence and uncertainty of life without needing it to be any different, including within our own practice. You know, so outstanding, and thank you for bringing that up. Hello, Matt.
Good to be here. Good to be here with everyone. I like this sutta because in its
pithiness.
The Buddha talks, yeah, and it's pithiness.
I like the word.
when the Buddha's talking about mindfulness and keeps coming back to mentioning one who's trained in Heartwood, it's like you said, talking about the Eightfold Path, and where do we begin there is right intention, to abandon craving and clinging.
Yeah.
So that initial intention is starting this journey to mindfulness.
Yeah.
Mindful.
It begins in right mindfulness.
It begins in right mindfulness, yeah, to abandon craving and clinging.
Yeah.
And then we get to start becoming mindful of how we crave and cling,
yeah,
or cling and crave. So I like how it's, you know, you guys have said jewel and multifaceted and all of these things. I think are very daft descriptions of it. So,
thank you, Frank. How are you?
Good. Good to be here. Good to see everybody. How are you, John?
Good. Thanks for asking.
I enjoy the Dhammapadas because they're short.
Yeah.
And they get right to the point. And when I read this, you know, a large part of my day is being mindful of the quality of my mind. And so when I read this, it kind of, you know, the Buddha teaches two things, the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Yeah. And what causes the cessation is understanding and being mindful of the quality of your mind. And when I do that, what gives rise to ignorance is the hindrances. When I'm caught in desire, or I'm caught in ill will, or, you know, pretty much those two are like the top rungs for me. you know, and I don't really see anything wrong with looking at Facebook or Instagram or checking some things out or wanting to go on vacation or enjoying the pleasurable things in life. When it becomes a problem is when it gets me caught up, and
yep,
that's all I can think about. And then there's the craving and the clinging. And so I don't know if it's the craving or the clinging, but it's probably the ignorance that's given the rise from the hindrances that I'm caught in. And if I'm mindful of the quality of my mind and then I'm caught up in a hindrance, then it's easier for me to understand and fall back into right view.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Wow, outstanding. Thank you. Yeah, the Dhamma doesn't teach us that we shouldn't enjoy our life. In fact, it's just the opposite. We go on vacation or do whatever the Dhamma teaches us to enjoy life in a completely impersonal way. In other words, we go on vacation, and vacation is great. If it happened to rain for 7 days, it rained for 7 days. It doesn't matter. There's no me in it. We're not doing things because of their inherent distracting nature. We're doing them simply because we're having a human life. Outside, it looks like just the same to most people and even to ourselves. But inside, there's a calm. We're still doing the same thing. We understand what's going on in the world. We're finally living our life moment by moment as a human life is supposed to be lived. Not thinking about what we need or what we need to avoid. We're mindfully present with life as life occurs. That's mindfulness. Eric, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Good to be here. I don't think I have anything to add. It was just very clear, like what was said. Mm-hmm. And it just made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, good. Glad you're here. David, how are you tonight?
Good, John. I'm good tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Mary.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody. The clarity and simplicity of what was said, you know, in this moment, it's it feels like right view and understanding and of the concepts and the experience. And then with jhana practice, the ability to practice that off your cushion in all the distractions of life, mm-hmm. because we live in the phenomenal world. So as with each sutta, it just makes more and more sense. And the bridge from the cushion to living in the phenomenal world is much simpler.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah. It's just an aspect of Dhamma practice in mm-hmm. that way. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary. Tim, good to see you tonight.
Yeah. Good to see everybody. While reading on mindfulness on the foundations and reading the sutta and everything, it seems there's a couple things I'd like to just ask you first.
Sure.
Well, for that, I wanted to just mention that. But with mindfulness, right? Mindfulness really can only be achieved with that concentration intact.
Mm-hmm.
And having the dispassion, you know, and the recognition of when your feelings and thoughts are arising, having that concentration intact allows us to recognize them and to move forward.
Yes.
At that moment.
Yep. And without concentration, we can't do that vital step in the Dhamma.
And that's what the meditation's for. So
yep.
One thing I was, and I've mentioned this to you before over the last, ever since I've been coming to class. And we've all talked about the mind racing and being busy. And how can you abandon something that's suppressed? Because if it's suppressed, it keeps coming back like a record being like a skipping record.
Yep.
And I was thinking about that with my own practice and certain things that come up that I want to abandon. I know I want to abandon them, but then I'm on my cushion and the thought arises. And I figured, well, with the right mindfulness and with the right concentration, I'll get to the point where, okay, well, the thought's arising, just let it go. But it just seems like an annoyance, which is probably the bad term, but it's the suppressed thoughts. Like, you can abandon being annoyed at somebody. You can abandon being inconvenienced. You can abandon the anger of somebody cutting you off in traffic. But those conditioned emotions that are suppressed, that I think come up once your mind gets clear.
Okay. I don't mean to cut you off, but I got to stop you
rambling.
Because, no, you're not rambling, but you're inadvertently, you're building a condition on top of a condition on top of a condition. So another word for how do I say this? A suppressed thought is simply a thought or a thought construct that you're clinging to. That's why it comes up. And so you just said that when you're upset with another person, it's easy to abandon it. Why do you think it's so hard to abandon you're upset with yourself?
Self-identifying with
it. Right.
Because you're clinging to it. So it's not so much that it's a suppressed emotion that you need some kind of deep analysis to get at, it's not suppressed, is it, at all? It doesn't meet the criteria for suppression.
Right,
there
clinging,
it is.
Clinging to that thought.
Yes. And so even putting the label that, oh, this is something that's suppressed, mean puts a self-imposed difficulty on something that is just another random thought, even though it keeps coming up. So the brilliance of the Buddha is he realizes, he understood the nature of conditioned mind, and he didn't emphasize it to the point of distraction by analysis. Where is this coming from? Why is it happening to me? Who's in charge of this? It's just another thought rooted in ignorance. And so the Dhamma is the solution to the what keeps coming up in meditation. And I would ask Lorna to speak on this, if I can put you on a spot, because what you're describing is overcoming something that Tim is going through right now, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there you go.
It's funny you said that, because I was always thinking about the Lorna River when I thought of that. No, I'm serious, because really that's with the concentration. I'm going to let you go say what you want to say, but that's...
It's just recognize all that you've just said is just recognizing that's just your stuff. It's just your stuff.
Said it better than
I've got my stuff. Rom's got a soup bowl full of stuff. We all have our feelings and descriptions of what our stuff is. Mm-hmm. And what you've just said is just your stuff. Yeah. And all of that, everything you've just said, just abandon it.
And if it's my stuff, it's unique.
It. There's no such thing as suppressing it. You can't suppress it.
Suppression really is what Francis says.
Suppression is what leads to stress, to dukkha.
Yeah.
Or the attempt to keep doing it rather than be, I want to say grateful, but understand the fortuitousness, the fortunate nature of having a practice that allows you to deal with so-called suppressed emotions and thoughts. It allows you to see them clearly. There's nothing suppressed going on. It's just a mind. It's a mind doing it. Yeah, being a mind, and it happens to be your mind. So you're almost, and again, not to put words in your mouth, but you're kind of describing this is something that might be unique to me, and it's a difficulty that I'm having. When the truth of the matter is, it's the whole point of the Dhamma.
Right. Well, it was more. Yes. Absolutely. Everybody's.
So thank you for bringing it up, Tim.
What I was going to say is that the concentration allows me to recognize.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And in time,
through practice and perseverance. Yes.
Right.
For me, it's understanding the quality of my mind.
Yeah.
It's usually a hindrance. And if it's a hindrance, then my mind is in ignorance.
If it's uncontrolled, it is a hindrance. And that's why the reason why the Buddha taught one single meditation method for a single purpose, to deepen concentration, so we can do just what we're talking about. So we can apply refined mindfulness. Because if it's just this grasping after concepts and fabrications and abstract ideas, all we're doing is engaging in a practice that we agree is a simple distraction.
Isn't it also the transition from willpower and that failure of willpower every time because it's just becomes a tired muscle to wise restraint, then final release because your practice is developing and it's so that right effort. And to I've heard Lorna over the past couple of years and how that's developed, and you see before it was sometimes confusion or doubt, and it's transitioning to much more right now. So I use those examples for myself to see that with a practice that's developing in right effort, that's where you're going.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you, David. And again, what you're describing, Tim, is when the Buddha said, I'm teaching a Dhamma for those with just a little bit of dust in their eyes. That little bit of dust in your eyes is manifesting as something you see as a suppressed feeling when it is just another impersonal thought that has no meaning or power except that it's there as a distraction. Recognize it, come back to your breath. And we all know the more that you do that, the less those things come up because they're simply no longer being clung to. There's no vehicle inside me that is acting to suppress something anymore. What an important thing you bring up. Julie, can I go to Kate and then I'll come back? You'll be next?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Hello, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Just to push off of what Tim was just saying, about the mind racing and stuff, and you kind of said all this, but it neurologically, like, that's how our minds are.
Yep.
That's the default. They're programmed to run all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, so it helps when I'm in that place to remember that's just what it's supposed to be doing. It's the mind being a mind, like you said.
And that depersonalizes
right.
it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it kind of helps you remove yourself a little bit from it. And same thing, I do the reminding myself, like, this thought is just a thought. It's just a thought. It's, next second it's going to be something else or it's going to be gone. So, all of that is just stuff I constantly remind myself. And it's just, it's helped. And everyone's talked about, sort of some of the lines in this chapter that jumped out at them. The one that jumped out at me was awake among those who are asleep.
Yeah. I like that one too.
Yeah. That I stopped on that one when I read it because that to me is a very accurate description of what it feels like when you're doing this right.
Yeah.
You're like a little more awake for your life. You're a little more
awake
to your how you cause yourself to suffer. And one of the best things about this practice, and also one of the most maddening things about this practice for me, is once you see what you're doing, you can't unsee it. And so as you're making your way through that, it can be frustrating. It's a struggle.
It's like that t-shirt I saw, reality sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know that you're responsible for it now. You can't.
Yeah. And you're like, oh no, now it's me. I have to do it.
And during the stream.
And there's great power in that too, though, isn't there? And that's where all our power resides there, in that idea.
Yeah.
There should be dispassion with that, right? The ego is in place correctly.
What's that?
Yes.
There should be dispassion with that if the ego is in place correctly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it just is.
So, Catherine, you're describing the development of refined mindfulness. It's just that way. And it wasn't all that hard, was it?
Yeah, I'm a year in, so it's, it wasn't that hard. But looking back on it, it's been really good.
Yeah. Thank you. Julia.
John, thank you for the teaching and everything today. I just wanted to make a strange experience that I had this week. Usually I'm okay during the day. I can control, my self-referential things. But this happened to me in the morning when I woke up. I woke up from a very bad dream, and the dream was extremely impactful. It wasn't like, I knew that it was a dream, but it had a lot of things that were like very hurtful things deep inside that I thought were gone, and they were just suppressed deep inside.
Mm.
And so I woke up, of course, and it was emotional and all that. And I immediately said, okay, this is a dream, but it was very painful. I had literally pain in my chest from that experience, almost like an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
And so I sat up and I just started to meditate immediately but it was difficult to meditate. The thought kept on coming back in, and I kept on having to breathe again. And then I would calm down, and then again it would come, and I'm like, it's not going away. Even going to work, Michael called me, and then we were talking about, the Dhamma, and talking about, the conditioned mind, and how these thoughts that I was having was, from some deep-seated stress, that I was kind of making mine, making my own.
Yep.
And it was difficult because even during the day, I have to go back constantly to the breath. And I thought, wow, that was a nasty thing from the past, that I didn't think it was so profound and so deep rooted in me, you know?
Yeah.
So I had a difficult time with that. I don't know, John, if you can give me advice how to get rid of that.
Sure. Thank you. The best thing to do is don't ever dream.
Say wait.
It's important to understand that a dream is the same thing as not having a dream. It's just mental energy. We because dreams can seem so real, and so we have a physical reaction, just like you said, your chest was hurting. It seems more than just what was occurring, but just what was occurring was your mind churning stuff up. And it wasn't something from the past that was occurring in your dream. It was your dream that was occurring in your dream. Do you see the difference?
It has references to the past, but yes, I knew. And Mike would come and say, what is cognized is cognized. I'm like, I don't really understand.
Yeah, and so in a dream, it's just a dream. Mm-hmm. And again, it doesn't mean that your reaction was somehow unskillful. It was your reaction. And you did exactly what a wise Dharma practitioner would do. You entered meditation, you did your best to unite your mind back in your body, and you went about your day. It wasn't the instant panacea we'd all want it to be, but that's why people take drugs, because they work so quickly. You even bringing it here and talking about it is part of a authentic Dharma practice, isn't it? So despite the upset, the whole thing unfolded exactly as it had to unfold. And I would say you address the issue just like a Dharma practitioner should. So thank you for bringing it up here too, because that's not isolated. We all have that. You know, we tend to overemphasize even those kind of things, mostly because we don't understand dreams, but dreams are just part of having a human life. Human beings dream. So thank you. Yeah. Michael, good to see you.
Same here, John. Thank you once again. This is a really good sutta. I really enjoyed reading it. It's short, like Frank said, and you get into them and get through them, and there's a lot in them. So part where I thought was interesting is this part where it says, glorious are those energetic, pure, discerning rightly, restrained, always mindful. Mindful is right effort. A disciple of heart wit, the wise are an island unto themselves that no flood can overwhelm. To me, that is such strong, again, words. I'm not like hanging on the words, but there's almost like an underlying current that certain words are like, kind of like there's a meaning there, and an understanding and a discernment of how we should, you know, read this, you know, and when you, words like pure and discerning rightly, restrained, always mindful, a disciple, you know, later down it says peaceful sage. This individual is an island unto themselves, okay? That to me means that they have come to the cessation of ignorance, okay? And that they cannot be touched by this sea of ignorance that surrounds them, because they are grounded in living the integrated Eightfold Path.
No,
that's just the way I interpret it.
That's it. You interpret it rightly. Thank you. Before we get to Kathleen, do you guys got to leave? Frank and Eric, can you hang on till the end? Because I just want to give instruction on our next week.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Kathleen.
Hello. I don't want to comment on what we talked about tonight. The picture on the wall is really compelling to me.
This one?
Yes. I sat with a very dear friend as she was crossing over, and for 2 days her eyes were like that.
Mm-hmm.
And periodically she would come back and have something very, very specific and clear to say, and then she'd go back into the half-closed eyes again. Mm. And so that's, it affected me last week, and it is again this week too. Mm.
That is quite a profound experience, isn't it?
It is.
Being with someone at the end.
I've been with people a few times as they've crossed over, and it is the most, I'm a Lenape woman, and I belong to a medicine society, a religious organization, and we do the crossing over, we do the funerals. And I was able to wash her body after she passed and dress her in her ceremonial dress. That is the most intimate thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, I can't imagine anything
ever.
Yeah.
And to be able to witness the crossing is, it's a gift, you know?
Yeah.
It's a gift.
And it's a profound experience of impermanence.
Yeah.
Because alive and death, there's no difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really, thank you. Hello, Karen.
Hello. Thank you so much for your teaching and patience and help. And I love what everyone shares and can relate to so much of it. It is a wild journey.
Yeah.
There's so much to it. And I'm very happy to be on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and being part of our Sangha.
Thank you.
Hello, Liz.
Hi, John. I was just thinking as I was sitting here how, as I have been able to carry the Dhamma with me more throughout the day, and as I've become a calmer person and less reactive, how much I used to engage in the drama of phenomenal life, and how now there are people who think I'm not responding to them because I'm not getting on the emotional train.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, and it, not that it was anything, you know, major or really important that happened, but there was a point where I just really didn't have a response to something. And I usually do, so it's interesting to sort of watch how your life sort of changes around you.
Yeah. Thank you. To some people, a wise Dhamma practitioner might seem aloof at times, but it's just because we've learned to not get entangled in the world and things that there's no reason to be entangled in. Mm-hmm. That's how we maintain a calm and peaceful mind. Thank you. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, John. I don't know how to wrap this one up. But
bring it home, Bonnie.
I think
what a sangha.
Rowing a boat. It's dark, it's light, it's dark, it's light, it's dark, it's light. But I think what I hold in mind is that to try to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind, so that to be gentle and compassionate, despite what wherever I am is where I am, and what arises, if I can name it, and really, because we're talking about suppression, so if I don't name it, I think it keeps coming. So if I can, when it arises, and I can name it, and it's like seeing what's in the dark, putting a light on the sea. But what's a relief is that the Eightfold Path, no matter where I enter in the stream of that path, can assist me in that process. So I have to keep reminding myself that it's there, reminding and remembering, because the conditioned mind, of course, brings us to you know, that behavior that helps but to be witness, to remember that the Eightfold Path, I can, once I go select the dark and light, to step back into that path, and I see it as a ladder almost.
Yeah.
You know, or sometimes it's sideways, sometimes it's up and down, whatever. I can, and we've talked about this before, being able to enter it at any point, and that it's circular in some ways, so that it brings you back to home and to be able to sit in that space. So mm-hmm. I'm certainly far from always being light, but if you know, hearing the suttas at different levels, like we've talked also, but we haven't talked about it in a long time, it's like the Nautilus. When you're walking around, it's like you come back to the same place and you're on a little bit of a higher plane. Yeah. Same issues, same ideas, mm-hmm. but hopefully you have more insight mm-hmm. at that point about being able to look. So. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you. What a good description of refined mindfulness. That's how it is. So we're going to start our Truth of Happiness Dhamma study for this year. It's going to be slightly different than we've done in the past. In other words, you're going to read the respective chapters, and then I'll give a brief talk on it. But what I'd like to hear is your understanding of what you read, and many of you have been now coming for quite a while, how it relates to the rest of the Dhamma. So at the end of each chapter in the book is instructions to write out a couple paragraphs about what you learned, and if you're taking the correspondence course with me, to send it to me and we'll have that discussion. What I'd like you to do, and please do the writing, because the writing uses a different part of your brain. You'll realize something in your writing that you haven't learned before. Read this week we're going to read the preface, the introduction, and the first chapter called Shamatha Vipassana. I haven't changed the chance to revise the book to say jhana, but everybody knows that Shamatha Vipassana means jhana meditation. Preface, introduction, and that first chapter. Write a couple of paragraphs on it and bring it back here. And those online, if you're doing the study with us, and I hope you are, you can do the same thing. You can bring it to class next time you come to class, and we'll talk about it. And if you also want to send it to me, you can. There was something else I wanted to say about that. I think that's it. So everybody's got that? Mm-hmm. How we're going to do this. And the book is online as well as for sale. And I got a couple of copies over here. But that's how we'll do it. And then I think I've said it already. This summer, we're going to go through the entire Dhammapada right after our retreat. So I think that's it. We'll finish with metta, as we always do.
John, I'm sorry. Preface, introduction, and
the first chapter one. Which is in the book, it's Shamatha Vipassana Meditation. See you, Frank. See you, Eric.
Hi.
Good to
Hi.
See you guys.
Do the old books, are they still sufficient? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, there's not that much difference. I can't even remember what. I think I expanded on dependent origination and something else in there. But.
Great.
But if you want a fresh copy, just take it. All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, content and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for joining tonight. Thank you online. Peace.
Thank you, John.
See you soon.
Bye, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.